Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
There have been investors who have been betting against the nation. No sane nation in the world would permit this kind of speculation on human tragedy. It is an anomaly in the capitalist system to permit this. Hold on, I'm getting something for you. It is an anomaly in the capitalist system to permit this kind of rapacious piracy. And if we had a sane government that was not totally, wholly owned, I believe that the governments of America are virtually wholly owned subsidiaries of the hedge fund operators. And I pointed this out in Trickle Up Poverty. Nightmare on Wall Street was a very important chapter, and I'm not going to read you from the chapter, but I try to tell you what was killing America and what is now killing the world. It's a few speculators in plain English. And unless they are reined in, there's going to be nothing left in the world. They are like the, remember the old Beatles cartoon, The Yellow Submarine, where the Know-Nothing Man? I don't know if you remember that. It goes back so long. Huh? The Nowhere Man. He sat on the top of a mountain with a large trumpet for a mouth. And he started sucking up the world and eventually sucked himself up into his own horn. That, to me, is what the hedge fund operators are. They have to be controlled. And many of you are so naive that you think that the words free market have some inherent magic in them. You've eaten the lie of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, who are basically shills for the Republican Party, as far as I can tell, or they're actually naive and don't even know what they're talking about. You don't understand there's no such thing as a free market. When you have rules that are broken, that's not a free market. A free market needs controls. It's like saying a freeway should have no rules on it. Now, you should be able to drive at any speed you want. You should have no stop signs, no lights on a highway. You can't have that. You'd have more accidents, right? Same thing in a stock market. Of course you need trading rules to constrain some of the more vicious piranha fish. And unless we have them put in place, we're going to see these rapacious hedge fund capitalists but betting against America, which they do on a daily basis. Who do you think is shorting the dollar? Who do you think is screwing around with our economy so that we can never climb out of this wreck that they caused to begin with? The very same people who put Obama in power.
I think that at the end of the day, though, what people are going to say is, who's got a vision for the future that can actually help ordinary families recapture that American dream? I don't think that the American people would dispute that at every step of the way, I have done everything I can.
Now, I want to now lead into the word culture wars, because when I first began in radio, the culture wars were everywhere, and these were big discussion topics. I'm going to read you some of these discussion topics from the 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and ask you what happened to the culture wars. Abortion, animal rights, bilingual education, creation evolution, family values, death penalty, drugs, flag burning, feminism, gun politics, law and order, media bias in the U.S., moral absolutism versus moral relativism, multiculturalism, permissivism, political correctness, euthanasia, secularism and secularization, the so-called separation of church and state, sexual education, stem cell research. Every one of those words has triggered a thought in your mind. Each one is a sort of explosive device. And yet, do you hear anyone discussing 99% of those topics anymore? Now, you wouldn't expect it to be discussed by anyone on the left because they've won on virtually every one of those points. I can go right down the list. It's as though the culture wars are over and the radical communist left has won. So what is left for them to do? If they've won, On the culture war front, what's left but to take away your dignity? And then after they take away your dignity and they take away your guns, they will take you away and put you into a re-education camp, as has been done by every Marxist revolution in the history of this sad earth. That's what's coming unless you start to understand what's at stake. Unless you stand up and fight back against these evil degenerates. Make no mistake about it. It's not just simply a choice between one way of looking at things and another, just a different lifestyle, just a different opinion. No, they're going after your dignity, then your guns, and then your freedom. That's exactly all I have left to take down. They've done everything else. They've debased virtually everything else that was worth holding on to in this society. They've beaten you on every level. I put up the good fight. I fought the good fight. When my day comes that I have to leave the earth, if I have a moment to think about it, I'll say, well, at least I fought the degenerate Bolsheviks with everything I had. I gave it everything I could. I threw everything I could at the enemy. Now you say, well, okay, you've done very well doing it. I did very well doing it, but it ain't over yet. I've also paid a very high price, and I don't want to sit here and cry to you. That's my problem. I took on a government, and I lost. Do you understand that? I took on a government, and I lost. The evil British government, the phony, fake, conservative British government under whatever his name is, who came along and promised that they would take my name off that list of banned individuals, joined with the communists, the so-called Labour Party, and kept me on a list with murderers and terrorists, which is a shocking thing to think that the vermin in the media won't even cover the story. But I'm not here to play victim. I'm a big, big man. I realize I got myself into trouble by speaking the truth to power. And I have to dig myself out of the hole. And I want to thank all of you who have and continue to contribute to the legal fund. Without you, I would have been buried a long time ago. But thankfully, I have a fund and I'm fighting them and I haven't given up. I want you to know that. But there are other fights to be had, both domestic and foreign. And the fact of the matter is, you're not fighting them. When have you last fought over any of these issues? When have you last called a radio show and heard a discussion about abortion, about animal rights, family values? Why that went out with Newt Gingrich. Death penalty? When have you last talked about the death penalty? When have you last talked about the drug war and the drug war's failures? When have you last talked about flag burning, about feminism, about the media bias in the U.S.? Well, we do that on a fairly regular basis. We know what that is. Have you last heard anyone fighting over multiculturalism and how it's devastated the dominant culture in the society and how multiculturalism is a code word for attacking whitey? Have you last, when have you last heard anyone arguing over euthanasia? You've given up on that. When they put your grandmother to sleep because they don't have the money to take care of her, you'll say, oh, well, I guess it's better that way. Then there's more more money in the Obamacare system for the drug addict. When have you last heard anyone arguing over about breaking churches off war memorials, breaking crosses off war memorials, which the communists do? Have you recently discussed abstinence as opposed to sexual mania? Have you recently heard a discussion or an argument over stem cell research? No. Since Obama, the Marxist, has come to power, they have assumed they won all of these battles. And with the check-pants Republicans running the other side, they have won on all of these issues. So I'm trying to tell you why I'm so agitated over Obama continuing to not only degrade and denigrate the United States of America, but the language itself, the way all Marxists work. I've told you what they do. They destroy the culture, first from within and then from without. But he glorifies in it. He glories in his decimation of everything decent about our society, doesn't he? He literally takes a certain, you can almost taste the pleasure he gets in inviting an illiterate gutter rat to the White House. He has tremendous pleasure in what he is doing. And there's not a word coming out of the media on this. You may hear it here and there on talk radio. I think it's a pretty big topic on talk radio, what he did by calling this garbage poetry when we know it isn't poetry. And yet he invited these failures from the universities and from the streets and from the record companies, obviously in order to appease and appeal to a certain base levels of the electorate. But some of them actually had the nerve to compare rap music to Shakespeare. I doubt that they've ever read Shakespeare. I don't think they could quote anything from Shakespeare. But listen to clip 24 when you will hear one of these illiterates invited onto the Fix News Network in 24.
So I think you can pull out lyrics from Shakespeare, and they would be offensive, you know, kind of under these standards.
See the word offensive? That's a radical left-wing word for anything that they find objectionable. They call it offensive. It offends them. This is not about offensive lyrics. You see, she misses the point on purpose. The entire structure of rap music is offensive. It's not that all of Shakespeare is offensive. Sure, you can pull a word out here and there and it might be offensive, but it's not about Shakespeare's literacy that we're arguing. We're arguing about the illiteracy of the individuals that the Obamas invited into our White House and debased it by inviting these individuals into the White House and calling it poetry. Of course, that would take a little degree of thought to come up with what I just said. And so, sure, hip-hop may reflect the current situation in urban ghettos. So, big deal. Does that make it poetry? No. It makes it a political statement, not poetry. But this is what the radical vermin on the left have done to our universities over the last 20 years. They have destroyed the English language itself. They have let people who they let into the universities who never qualified to even be there in the first place. They rigged up the exams. They destroyed standards. They brought in people who could never qualify to be in a university for many different reasons. And they said, now you're a student. So when the student couldn't keep up with the class, they lowered the common denominator down to the level of the student. And suddenly they gave the student the ammunition by saying, oh, do you find it offensive that they're forcing you to read Shakespeare, a white male? Well, why don't you tell them how you see the world in your own words? The next thing you know, you wake up, click, click. There is the president of the United States, himself a product of all of this, by the way, ushered along every step of the way because of the political expediency of the radical left and the acquiescence of all those who knew better. And there we now see what he does when he's in the White House. He degrades and denigrates it on a daily basis.
Savage.
Kansas, Robbie, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Michael. George Soros does not hate America. His hatred is for humanity. Soros could care less about the country a man resides in. His hatred is for the man who resides. And you ask, how can he get away with it? Well, simple, Michael. In America, there is the meekness of the mob and a madness of the law. And that's the way he gets away with it.
Well, he owns the politicians. They're afraid of him because he buys them off.
Exactly. And the mob.
So who represents the American people? Tell me who represents the American people. If we had a representative democracy, he would be investigated, in my opinion, for currency manipulation at the very least.
Michael, no one represents the American people. We've become servile, and we are slaves. We just don't realize it yet. And
oh, God, is that chillingly true?
The mob is meek, and the laws are mad. And the meeker the mob gets, the madder the laws become. And I have to correct...
Robbie, you're a very well-educated man. Who are you quoting?
This is G.K. Chesterton. Wrote it back in the 20s about the eugenics movement.
My God. I assume that you read about the fall of Rome at many times in your education, Robbie, didn't you?
I've read a lot. Yes, sir.
What people don't know is that when you look at ancient history and the fall of Rome, it was actually the end of civilization, of Western civilization. You're aware of that, I'm sure.
Yes, Michael.
And how did Rome fall? Allegedly, it was a result of vicious barbarian invasions during the 5th century, which destroyed the all-powerful Roman Empire and its centuries-old civilization, and then brought in a dark age for all the people of the West. All the people of the West. So who would the barbarians be today, using that analogy, Robbie? Who would the barbarians be who are out to destroy our civilization?
Well, there's people like Kissinger. There's people who hate humanity. They have a hole inside their soul that can only be fueled by the destruction of man. And the more they destroy it, the better they feel, because the void can never be filled, because they are depraved. And there is no rationale to the madness. And it's gone throughout history. This is nothing new. It's human nature. And the problem is we've become so drugged over that we seem to forget our instincts and that is that it's the fight or flight, and we'll neither fight nor flight. We'll just stand here and just wait in line.
Well, people should know that Rome didn't disappear. It's just that all of the civilization surrounding Rome and the comforts of the civilization disappeared. And it was during the middle years of the 5th century that Italy slipped away into Germanic hands. In other words, the Germans occupied Italy at that time. That was the end of the Roman Empire. It didn't exactly disappear. It just became sort of run by Hell's Angels, in essence.
Well, look at the Colosseums in Rome. They were built to pacify the people, to keep their mind off of sports. Look at America today. Look at the news.
Mm-hmm. Let me read you a line from The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization by Brian Ward Perkins. It was a book given to me by my good friend, Congressman John Culberson of Texas, when he came out to visit us with us, and in March 24th, he went to an event with us, and he wrote to Michael Savage, a great American who will be decisive in saving America from following the Roman Empire. And I want to read you one paragraph: the use and the threat of force. The Germanic invaders of the Western Empire seized or extorted through the threat of force the vast majority of the territories in which they settled, without any formal agreement on how to share resources with their new Roman subjects. The key words here are seized or extorted. I believe we are being extorted daily, and that our so-called representatives are no longer our representatives. The only hope we have at this time has to be led by the Tea Parties. They must become more passive. They cannot permit the phony Republican Party to completely deball them. They must now become more Americans. During the election, when Gore tried to seize the presidency against Bush, do you remember those young men from Cuba with the white shirts in Florida who ran into the polling areas where the vermin with law degrees from NYU and Columbia had been bussed in to rig up the vote? Remember, they came in and started pounding on the glass, and it chased all of these little cowards back to New York? Well, that's what we need. We need young men and women in white shirts and ties pounding on the glass of the vermin on the left.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I'm going to take a caller right now from Kansas. Mark, you're on the one and only Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it is a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've been listening for a long time. I wanted to say I'm just amazed in this day and age, in 2011, with someone as learned as yourself, who just is one of the smartest people I listen to, can even believe in a God today. I mean, it shocks me, actually. That
I like that. I like shocking you. Do you find it offensive that a man of intelligence would believe in God?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's absolutely never been any proof of it. And in fact, if you're, Catholic or someone who believes in the Bible, it was admittedly written by man. I mean, at least Muslims and other religions, try to act like it was, that their word was written by God. But I mean, even I was raised.
Okay, I've heard your discussion. I don't reject what you have to say, nor am I going to here to try to turn you into a religious person. But let me ask you something: do you believe Albert Einstein was super intelligent?
Of course.
Okay. Are you aware that Albert Einstein was a great believer in God?
Yes, I am.
Okay. No. I don't know, because a lot of atheists are confused because of the college posters of Einstein with the hair and with the tongue out that they put on campuses in order to debase his image. He said the more he studied the perimeters of the universe, the more he came to believe there had to be a God.
Right. But I also believe that religion is something that can shape you throughout your entire life. Things that he had gone through had, for some reason, he had questions that could not be answered. And so he turned to religion, much like yourself. You had said that, you had discovered him when you had hit the bottom. I think that, like some people out there, I hate to bring up his name, but like Jesse Ventura or even like George Carlin used to say about God, that really it's something that if you have this hole in what you you know, think is life and you have no answers for that, you have to go to this, you know, invisible man that is supposedly up there watching everything we do and all the evil that...
No, I've heard the atheistic arguments, and it's all, you know, it's sort of hollow, the whole thing, because have you not had black moments in your life where there was nowhere to go? Who do you turn to? What do you turn to?
With religion, you're told that God only helps...
No, but I'm asking you as a believing atheist. You believe in the religion of atheism, which is believing in nothing and nothingness, but you actually believe in something, which is nothingness, when you think about it.
I more believe in people or something physical than something that...
But have you ever fallen down a ravine and broken your leg and been laying there with no one to rescue you? Who would you call?
There's no one to call. I mean, what good would calling God do? I mean, someone hears you.
So you'd pick up your cell phone and you wouldn't dial G-O-D, you dial 911. I get it.
Right. I mean, I don't think it's an argument. You know, I don't even want to say it's an argument. It's really just your belief system. You know,
that's right. You're not going to convince me not to believe in a supernatural being that controls the universe. But you got to understand this about me. I do not believe God is omnipotent. I believe God is omnipresent. You know, there's a big difference.
That he's everywhere at all times, but he doesn't know everything.
See, many years ago, I went through a whole soul searching where I was about to become a total atheist. And I'd ask myself, how could a little child suffer from leukemia like this? How could a little child have cancer and suffer so violently? Why is it that evil men seem to thrive and get away with murder and rape and killing hundreds of thousands of people, while the innocent children, sometimes you go to a backward of cancer and you see suffering amongst children? I said, what kind of God is there in heaven with a thing like this? And I found a book on this. It was written by I believe it was a Reform rabbi, and he was more a philosopher. And he said that if he believed God was omnipotent but not omnipresent, he would cease believing because he would not accept the God that was so cruel.
I guess I got to apologize. And when you say omnipresent, you mean that he's everywhere at all times or what? I mean, what's the difference between...
I believe that God's work is apparent everywhere. If I'm sitting in my radio studio looking out of the window and I see a bush and I see an airplane and I see the breeze and I see a bird... Okay, these are all manifestations of God to me.
Okay.
To me. It doesn't mean I see a spiritual being walking around who's going to wind up in my living room. I'm not Jimmy Carter. I don't believe he's going to show up in a white robe in my living room and I have to drink strychnine in order to prove it.
That's all the proof you need that there is a God, is because there are these things that are present that you see every day.
Yes, in other words, how could this ever happen by accident?
I think that there's many, many things, and I think you'd agree with this, there's many, many things in the world that cannot be explained by us. I think that man is, you know, pretty low on the...
Wait, but you just touched again on something you've struggled with all your life, and I agree with you. There are many things we can't understand. So what do you do at that moment when you reach a point you can't understand? What do you turn to? I don't understand it, and that's enough for you?
No, I try to study as much as I can of things that have actually happened and people that have lived in the world and experienced what is to experience in the world and maybe what they're... I kind of see it as a study that you spend your whole life trying to...
Look, we're not going to change each other's mind. A belief is a faith. That's all there is. It's a faith and period. You can't prove it. It's a faith. That's why it's called faith-based.
In this horrible, disgusting world with what goes on every day, how can you have faith in this being? Even if there is a God, say that there is a God. If there is a God, how could he be such an incredibly cruel being to allow what happen in the world? You know how there was...
I have asked the same question. I've gone right there. I'm not different than Mother Teresa, who doubted God's existence at times in her life, but still trekked along on the path of God. Because there's no alternative. I cannot take myself off this path at this point in my life. It's impossible.
You know the story of Noah's Ark, obviously. Flood, you know, because everything was so evil in the world that he needed to wash it clean, basically, and start over. You can't tell me that after all these thousands of years after that things are not 10,000 times worse than they were back then. And
yeah, but who says there's not going to be another flood?
There could be, but it's been so long. I mean, there's just no...
Yeah, it's been a long time. That's why I have survival food on a hillside house somewhere.
I'm with you. I mean, I do think it's probably coming, but I think we're more likely to destroy ourselves before that actually happens. But I just...
Yeah, that's a whole separate discussion. I want to ask you something. You've got my curiosity. Were you raised in any religion?
I was raised as a Catholic. I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. I was confirmed in the Catholic religion, although at confirmation I was right towards the time of not, you know, of really falling out of belief.
But what made you a lapsed Catholic? Something happened in your life? What happened?
You know, I was the weird kid that was like 9 or 10 years old in Catholic. You know, if you're in Catholic schooling, you go to church probably 2 or 3 times a week. And so I would sit in church and the priest would want us to be involved. So he would ask us questions. And I would be the weird kid that stood up and said, okay, look, you know, if there is a God, then, you know, why does the bad things happen? Blah, blah, blah. And they never had
yes.
an answer for me.
All right. No. Hey, that happens in every religion. Every religion has kids who ask these questions. You're not the weird one. You're the smart one. You're the one who challenges authority. I understand that, but I've been that way all my life.
Right. I felt weird because there was no other child, and in fact, I was laughed at for even.
See, here's the thing about it. Do you do things in your life that you're ashamed of? Things that you really wish you didn't do?
Of course.
Okay. So who do you apologize to for that?
There is nobody to apologize to.
Don't you do any mea culpa saying, God, I'm sorry, I've sinned, I can't help myself?
No.
What do you say to yourself? What do you say to yourself at that point?
You know what? I don't. I don't have those kind of internal monologues. I basically try to live my life. You know, I feel that the Ten Commandments are a great way to live. I think that, you know, all of the things that they list are things that you should probably try to do.
Did you say the Sixth Commandments? You're sounding like Anthony Weiner now.
No, I said the Ten Commandments.
I'm joking. Come on. Because most Democrats believe in four commandments.
If you listen to George Carlin, it should really be like two, because a lot of them
overlap. No, but most Democrats believe in four commandments. Well, it's an interesting conversation we've had so far, Mark. We haven't changed each other's position, and nor did we try to. We were like gentlemen having a discussion, which is the object of a discussion, which is not really to move the other guy, but just hear the other guy out. Would you agree with me on that?
Absolutely, yeah. I listen to you every day. I do love your show a lot, and I really do believe that you are just an incredibly intelligent person. I can't believe the radio is where you landed up, you know, from being a professor and being all these things that you could have been or have done in your life, that you didn't go into a different path, and you're basically...
Well, I know that it's very interesting, but I was blocked in my desires to make a life in academia because I was a white male, although my credentials were the best on earth. They were only choosing people who were of a certain, let's say, stripe. But that's a long time ago. I have a large classroom every day with 8 to 10 million listeners a week. You can do the math. I mean, the audience is bigger in one probably 10-minute period than I would have had in my entire life as a professor. So things worked out very well. Also, the sale of the books is great. I have no complaints on that level at all. I'm not sitting here grousing about what happened. It was all, and I'm going to say this something now you're not going to believe, it was all God's will. See, I actually believe that it was all God's will. God did not want me to be limited to be a professor. He wanted me to be the voice of reason on the air.
Savage.
What happened when Rome fell? I mean, what was life like? Because you say, well, Rome fell. What does it mean to you? There's one line I have to read to you. From the Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization by Brian Ward Perkins. And they go, in other words, with the fall of the empire, art, philosophy, and decent drains all vanished from the West. Listen to what he wrote. After the empire fell, art collapsed, philosophy collapsed, and decent drains all vanished from the West. As you well know, art died in the United States of America circa, I would say, roughly 1950. There is no philosophy in the United States of America to speak of. There are ideas, but there are no schools of philosophy, so far as I know, that would be the equivalent of a school of philosophy of Aristotle or Plato. And then in terms of decent drains, take a look at the infrastructure of American cities. Coming back from any airport, especially here in the San Francisco area, you see highways where weeds are growing out of the pavement. You see potholes. I mean, I drive over the Golden Gate Bridge. And I marvel how an iconic structure such as this, which is such a powerful magnet for tourism, can have been permitted to fall into such disarray by the vermin who run this city and run the bridge is astounding to me. The roads are broken. There are potholes entering and coming off the bridge from San Francisco. And they rape and steal hundreds of millions of dollars a year from people with tolls, and no one knows where the Golden Gate Bridge tolls go. Why? Corruption. So again, we go back to this history. Why? History is a great instructor. Those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, are we repeating it. So again, I'll read that one line again to you. In other words, with the fall of the empire, art, philosophy, and decent drains all vanished from the West. As I said, there has been no art in America to speak of, no great art anyway, for at least 70 years. There's no philosophy that I can think of, maybe I'm wrong, and decent drains would refer to the infrastructure, which vanished from the West. So in essence, the prognosis from Michael Savage is that we are witnessing not the coming death of a civilization, but the ongoing death of a civilization. Rome, you see, did not fall overnight. It took several hundred years for Rome to actually collapse completely. And this country is clearly in the throes of its death. These are the death throes of the United States of America. How else could you explain a president of this low caliber arriving in the White House? You remember I said to you that, what was it, the 1919 World Series were fixed by the gangster in New York. I forget his name. Does anyone remember? Arnold Rothstein fixed the 1918-1919 World Series. You say, how could you fix the World Series? He did so. Well, this election was fixed, in my estimation. It was rigged to put in a stooge of those who are destroying America. Barack Hussein Obama, he had the right exact mix of elements to slip through the American mind. And he's now doing what he does best, which is attacking the middle class, calling them the rich. But we've talked enough about this. I want to read you remarks from a devout Muslim, a wonderful man, Dr. Zudi Jasser. He's a devout Muslim. He's the president and founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He said the Muslim Brotherhood is the antithesis of a secular organization. Remember now, this is Dr. Zudi Jasser, a devout Muslim and the president and founder of the American Islamic Forum. He said that the DNI's statement presents a significant concern, blah, blah, blah. The Muslim Brotherhood, he says, is built on the ideology of political Islam, which adheres to a belief in Islamic supremacy. He said further, the Muslim Brotherhood is a threat to the political process in a post-Mubarak Egypt. Thugs like Mubarak have created an atmosphere that has allowed the Brotherhood to thrive. The United States needs to be active within the country of Egypt, countering the ideology of the Brotherhood, helping the people of Egypt develop liberty-minded democratic infrastructure to secure the country's future. We need to demonstrate to Egyptians that freedom does not come in the form of Islamic law or in the rule of theocratic clerics. He then goes on to say, our intelligence community cannot afford to allow political correctness or this mistaken understanding of the Brotherhood to enter the conversation of how we will confront the changes in Egypt. Again, that's from a man who knows the difference between political Islam and such. Ohio Bob, you're on the Savage Nation.
What I really like about President Obama is his desire to lead us in his actions and trying to get us reduce our dependence on foreign oil as far as conservation and putting in green technologies. And
that's very good, Bob. And how long off do you think it is until we can actually use green technologies to power our power plants and to heat our homes and run our cars? You are aware that this technology is not yet here.
It's here in a lot of ways. I know. I was able to, when Jimmy Carter was in office, I was able to...
Let me ask you something. Do you own an electric car, Bob, like a Chevy Volt?
I'm going to buy a Volt. As soon as they come out,
You're going to buy a Volt because you're a do-gooder and you're a man who believes in saving the environment. That's very noble. Are you aware that it takes more energy to create the electricity to run that car than it does from the energy from oil and gasoline? Are you aware of the statement that I just made, the reality of that? In other words, where do you think the electricity comes from?
Okay, because in Ohio here, we burn lots of coal.
Bob, try to follow the discussion. Try to use logic. You understand that an electric car needs to be plugged in to work, correct?
My point is,
I'm asking you a question. Do you know where the electricity comes from, Bob? Or do you think it just comes out of the air?
It comes from a coal plant in Ohio.
Okay, so to run that coal plant produces what, Bob?
Electricity.
Yes, Bob, and what are the waste products of running the coal plant, Bob?
Michael, look, you have the equivalent...
Oh, no, you won't answer a question. Don't say, Michael, look, I'm not your son.
You realized that you couldn't win the checkers game, so you went to another checkers game. But let's stop playing backgammon with each other, Bob. If you want to be a fool and tell yourself that he's saving the earth, you can say that, but it's not true, Bob. It is not true scientifically. It's not true economically, because the technology is not yet here. I would love to be driving a hydrogen car. The technology isn't here. And little electric cars cost more and produce more pollution in the long run because of the production of electricity than does the use of oil and gasoline, Bob. That's the reality right now.
Mike, I care about getting us off Middle East oil. Now, I know
you do. Wait a minute. Then why is it that your hero stopped drilling in the Gulf of Mexico? That's not from the Middle East.
Because it hurt the economies of New Orleans so much. Mike, if you care
about... Whoa. What are you talking about? It's Obama who ruined the economies of New Orleans by stopping the drilling. Moreover, why doesn't he drill for oil in the Alaskan slope if he wants to get us off foreign oil?
Because as long as we have the oil Jones and don't turn all our attention to these technologies that we don't need this oil, how are we going to do
it? Bob, you're way out of your league. You see, you're a decent person, I'm sure, and you want to do good. But as you well know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The technology is not yet here to drive our homes to heat, to drive our cars to heat our homes. Don't you understand that?
Mike, how much gasoline do you use when you go out in your boat to support?
Bob, you're not following the discussion in any way. You just have your head in the sand and you want to believe Obama's doing the right thing because you're an idealist. You're an old hippie idealist. The fact of the matter is it costs more to run an electric car in terms of pollution, meaning you add up the electrical generation, than it does to get oil producing gas, Bob. But since you didn't go to school and you don't understand the science, we have to disengage from each other.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Your White House has faced a lot of questions on Solyndra, the solar panel company you paid a visit to back in 2010. You really held it up then as a model for jobs and clean energy. Do you regret that?
No, I don't, because if you look at the overall portfolio of loan guarantees that have been provided, overall, it's doing well. And what we always understood was that not every single business is going to succeed in clean energy.
Extra, extra, hear all about it. Energy Department approves another $1 billion in your tax money to two more solar energy companies after $535 million evaporated in smoke. Obama's Energy Department proved another $1 billion to two more solar energy companies. Can anybody tell me how this man gets away with it? Can anybody tell me how the Republicans are not demanding impeachment? Welcome to the Savage Nation. I'm Michael Savage. I got to tell you something. The middle of the night, I started to think the show was working already in my subconscious again. That's how this thing works. This is not purely from the conscious level. It's within my, it's encoded in me. And the first thing that came to my mind was, I'm going to go on the air and say I'm not going to talk about Obama anymore. I'm not going to bash Obama, but I don't know how to stop. You can't stop when you see such corruption and such anti-Americanism as occurring from this White House. It is almost impossible to not talk about this administration. The Energy Department announced that it has finalized more than $1 billion in loan guarantees for two separate solar energy projects. This decision is coming weeks after Solyndra,
a California-based solar manufacturer that received a $535 million loan guarantee from the Obama administration, filed for bankruptcy and fired 1,100 workers. The Department of Energy announced a $737 million loan guarantee to help finance construction of a Crescent Dunes solar energy project in Nevada, Harry Reid's home state. Almost $1 billion of stimulus money to Harry Reid's home state to a company called Crescent Dunes Solar Energy in Nye County, Nevada. The project is sponsored by Tonopah Solar, a subsidiary of California-based Solar Reserve. Look up their board of directors. Now let's go down the list. There is another facility. The Energy Department under this administration also announced that it had given away a separate $337 million loan guarantee to an energy project in Arizona. Again, a solar energy project. These loan guarantees are following the $550 million loan guarantees that disappeared and went up in smoke before. Ladies and gentlemen, what is it going to take for you to awake to the fact that we are not run by those who respect the rule of law, but those who run roughshod over the rule of law? At the same time, Light Squared, the other major scandal under Obama, Light Squared, remember that name? What is Light Squared? Well, you don't have to know all the details. It's a high-speed cell phone service company using a network of satellites and land-based cell towers. Sounds good, yes? Well, tests found that Light Squared had a network that interfered with GPS devices, a big concern for the U.S. military. The FCC decided the company would not get final approval for its network until this issue of interfering with the military's GPS is resolved. And so what has LightSquared just done? You want to hear the news? Here it comes. LightSquared has doubled the size of its lobbying team. Who are the lobbyists? Are you ready to hear the dirty names? Here are the filthy, dirty names, both sides of the aisle. Here are the new lobbyists working for LightSquared. Even though this company apparently has a product that interferes with our national security, it does not matter to Richard Gephardt, Missouri. It does not matter to former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, both lobbying for Light Squared. But if you think it's only dirty Democrats, you're mistaken. The company's K Street gangsters also includes prominent Republicans. Prominent Republicans who I will not even name. I'm too sick to even read their names. The fact of the matter is, this is a country not of the people, by the people, and for the people. It is a country of the lobbyists, by the lobbyists, and for the lobbyists. Take a look at your economy. Take a look at your military. Take a look at your social policies, and you'll know why it's impossible to stop talking about the most corrupt administration in American history. Woe to all of us that we have such a dumb population, a population of dumbbells who does not even understand. Not even an iota of understanding of the danger they are in, walking around like the dummies they are with their head in the clouds. Four more years of this corrupt administration, there will not be a United States of America. There will be a United Soviet States of America, as sure as I am sitting here. We've been talking about the corrupt Energy Department approving another $1 billion in so-called energy loans for solar after $535 million went missing. The crooks in the Energy Department, the crooks, gave away another $1 billion of money from stimulus funds. This article came out from the Gateway Pundit because you're not going to believe it. It's entitled Crony Socialism. Obama gives $737 million to solar firm linked to the Pelosi clan. It's as if Solyndra never happened. The Obama administration is giving $737 million to Tonopah Solar, a subsidiary of California-based Solar Reserve. PCG is an investment partner with Solar Reserve. Nancy Pelosi's brother-in-law happens to be the number two man at PCG. Obama is spending $737 million on this. The Energy Department gave away $737 million for a Nevada solar project. This is several weeks after a California-based solar manufacturer received $535 million in loan guarantees from the Obama administration that filed for bankruptcy and the money went up in smoke. Nancy Pelosi's brother-in-law also happens to be Are you ready? The uncle of ex-Mayor Gavin Newsom. That's correct. That's correct. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom's uncle. And now we find that there is a connection between the big gavel and the big loan. The big gavel and the big loan. Crony socialism ascends, says the Gateway Pundit. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about here on the Savage Nation? Or shall I tell you about pickles on the Lower East Side? Would you rather hear a meatball recipe? Because you're not going to get it from me today.
Savage.
Times I've used the phrase red diaper dopa baby to explain the problem that America is having today because of so many communist children who went on to using marijuana that they became totally psychotic. And I wasn't doing it in jest. I used the phrase RDDBs for years. I stopped using it. I think I should start referring to it again. I believe what we're seeing in America today, particularly in the Democrat Party, is the ascent of the RDDBs. Here's a study just came out, published in a major journal, which confirms what I've been saying to you for over 15 years. Cannabis doubles risk of psychotic episodes. Using cannabis in one's youth almost doubles the risk of having psychotic episodes like paranoia and hallucinations, a study has found. A team of international researchers followed the lives of almost 2,000 young Germans who began with no history of psychosis for more than a decade. They discovered that youngsters who started smoking the drug at college age were 90% more likely to have psychotic symptoms in their mid-20s. It's an amazing story, and I've told you this over and over and over again. The scientists believe that exposure to THC, the main psychoactive component in cannabis, makes the brain more susceptible to psychotic episodes. And now what's amazing is that we've known this for years in science, but cannabis is now being pushed as though it's mother's milk. Cannabis clubs? Pot clubs, medical marijuana, it's all a giant conspiracy to completely make the dumb even dumber. Why do you think it's called dope dope? Hey, dope, why do you think they call it dope dope? You think it makes you smarter? You think it makes you think better? Thinks you makes you more competitive? It makes you more easily manipulated, dope. This study adds a further brick to the wall of evidence showing that use of traditional cannabis is a contributory cause of psychosis like schizophrenia, said Sir Robin Murray, professor of psychiatric research at King's College London. And yet, pot clubs abound. America is flowing in the lies and the propaganda of marijuana. And I'm sorry to tell you who was behind it, because you're not going to want to hear it. Because I had an argument with one of his henchmen 7 or 8 years ago. George Soros has been pushing the legalization of marijuana for well over 10 years through his, I think, Open Society Institute or something to that effect. I believe Soros is one of the most demonically evil men in the history of the world. That's my personal opinion. Wherever you see something evil and wrong going on, you can see one of his front groups behind it. Media Matters, funded by Soros, attacked me, falsely accused me, took my comments out of context, and got me banned in Britain. Open Society, or whatever society, has been pushing a legalization of marijuana, first in Arizona, then in California. I had an argument with one of them on the telephone years ago. Again, George Soros. We know that marijuana is highly dangerous, and yet the young people don't know this. They think that it's just something like a beer. It isn't like a beer. It is not like a beer at all. It's extremely dangerous. Try to tell your children that if they don't believe you, the marijuana smoke itself has more carcinogens in it than tobacco smoke does. Are you aware of that? Again, you don't want to understand this. Oh, it's green. It's something natural. Curare is natural also. I can name 10 natural substances that can kill you. What does natural have to do with it? You think because it's natural, it's healthy? If it's natural, it can kill you as well. There are a lot of potent compounds in nature that are toxic. Marijuana is a toxic compound, extremely toxic. It explains to a great extent why the left wing is pushing medical marijuana, because it makes the people putty in their hands. Putty, if they're doped up on marijuana, if they're doped up on skunk, they can manipulate them like Nutty Putty. Cannabis is a risk factor for psychosis, and recommends a cautious and thoughtful approach to cannabis legislation coming out of England, of all places. Cannabis doubles risk of psychotic episodes. Major study. I don't think you'll be hearing much about it because the marijuana lobby right now in America is overwhelmingly powerful. New York, Andrew, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, how you doing there? Quick question. What is wrong with Obama talking about basketball? Tell me what is wrong with that. What is your...
Well, for an idiot like you, it makes perfect sense. For a person disconnected from reality as you are, the typical sports-loving American male, that is something that you would consider to be leadership.
I'm not a sports lover. It's just the fact that you're demeaning this man because he's talking about basketball.
That's right, of course.
Savage, let me get it in. You're talking about...
Andrew, I asked you, is basketball more important than the current currency crisis in America? I mean, be serious now.
Does he have to talk about 24 hours a day?
He doesn't talk about it at all, Andrew. He hasn't said one word about any of it.
You know, you're forgetting he's the president of the United States. The United States. Now, if he was doing more stuff, you would be saying, "Oh my God, he's not worrying about the United States." I mean, he's damn if you do, damn if you don't.
Andrew, listen. I know you're very excited, and you assume that your excitement is the equivalent of intelligence and reason. But you have to understand that excitement does not equal intelligence and reason. It just indicates stupidity in your case. The world is laughing at him. We have a crisis in our own country of epic proportions. Are you aware the dollar fell to its lowest value against the yen since World War II? Do you understand what that means?
Yes, yes, I understand.
Hold on. You say yes, yes. What does that actually mean?
That means that the value of our dollar is actually decreasing. I know.
And don't you think that that's a crisis worthy of discussion by the President of the United States?
No idea if he's discussing that in behind closed doors.
Oh, you mean in between the night basketball and the barbecues, he's racking his brain when we don't even see.
Right.
He's sort of a Lincoln-esque figure who is suffering all night long with the woes of the world, and he's only putting on a happy face for us. Oh, I didn't see that, Andrew. He's really a great leader. He's really great. Is there anything he could do that would have you doubt him at all?
Yeah, it's things that he does that he can doubt. I mean, he can be a little, he's a little weak in the foreign policy. Of course, he can be a little stronger in foreign policy, but you can't.
What do you mean stronger in foreign policy? In which area?
They say that his relations dealing with how he handles certain things and how he handles the war that's going on, and people in Afghanistan not pulling out the troops, and that his policy is a little weak. He's not that strong. And foreign policy. That's one of the big things to say. Well, he's not a good foreign policy man. He doesn't do this and that.
So you agree he's weak on foreign policy? Oh, at least we have some common ground. And you say he's strong on domestic policy? In which area?
I believe he's one of the first presidents that actually conquered the health issue and actually tried to make some sort of dent.
Sir, what do you mean by conquered the health issue? Are you aware that this corrupt president has granted 1,000 waivers to Obamacare to anybody who pays their way out, they can get out? It's not even in the bill. Do you understand that this is total corruption? Are you aware of that, Andrew?
Right, but what I'm saying is...
What you're saying is you're a dummy who doesn't know what he's talking about, and you just still have an opinion because you're from New York, and you figure a big mouth equals intelligence. Do you understand that 1,000 waivers that are not even in Obamacare were granted to individuals and corporations who don't want any part of this nightmare called Obamacare? By the way, are you willing to pay for health care for illegal aliens yourself?
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
Well, but wait a minute, Andrew. It's in Obamacare. It means that this conquering of this health mess that you just referred to, part of it includes health care for illegal aliens, and you have to pay for it. How can you say that that's a good thing?
I never said that. You're saying that. You're thinking that I have that. You're thinking because of my comments that I have blind allegiance and everything that Obama does is so great. No, that's not. That's not what I'm saying. But do you think referring to the White House as a disco and saying that Obama's never ate so well? Do you think that serves intelligence? Do you think your snide comments?
Yes, I think my snide comments are sufficient to have had 200,000 people buy my book in hardcover and about 8 million people a week listen to me. Yes, I think my snide comments do have some value. Yes, Andrew, I do.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Let's start with the basics here. It's easy to say eat the rich, get the rich, kill the rich, you know, arrest the rich, hang the rich. Be careful, because most of you listening to this show would like to be rich. That's number one. If you scratch the surface of virtually any man in this country, you're not going to find a man who doesn't dream of success, whether it be through a book he writes, no matter how leftist he is. Take a look at the fatso. What's his name? The ugly fat man, the liar. I can't remember. The movie maker, the ugliest man in the history of filmmaking. Michael Moore, the ugliest man that God ever created. Here's a guy who sells total chicken feed to the left-wing fools who flock to the theaters to buy his lies, and he's a very rich man. He didn't exactly give his money away, did he? So if you scratch the surface, everybody wants to be rich. So before you start saying hang the rich, be careful. We're not saying hang the rich. We're talking about people we believe committed illegalities who have not yet been prosecuted because they own the government. They are the government. This is what I'm trying to tell you. Obama's not the government. Biden is not the government. They were put in power by these people and by others you never heard of. In the minds of those who have studied this, they are the front men. You know, like in England, there's the Queen. The Queen of England, who is a figurehead of the government. She's a figurehead, rather, of the nation, excuse me. In that way, our president has long been merely a figurehead. It didn't start with Obama. However, I would say it's rather magnified under Obama. He's clearly just a figurehead. You can see this, how he's over his head in so many places, such as the fool he made of himself in England while going on and on a speech while the Queen started to say play the music. So he's a figurehead. He's a puppet, in other words, of people who put him in power. Who are they? How come Bonnie Frank is not indicted for what he did? How come? Because they run the government. They are the government. It's not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's a government, of the bankers, by the bankers, and for the bankers. Now, again, this feeds into a popular notion, which is that some bankers run the world. Well, guess what? The bankers run the world. In that money is the mother's milk of politics. Yes, the bankers run the world. Okay, let's start with reality. Yes, the bankers run the world. It doesn't mean, though, that all bankers are evil, corrupt, or criminals. But some are. There are criminals in all classes of the professions. There are great doctors. There are saintly doctors. And then there are shyster criminals. Sometimes the shyster criminal doctors go to jail. Most of the time they don't. But when have you last seen a banker get indicted and go to jail? Answer, never. Now, the reason that they don't go to jail, here's the interesting part. It's not so much that they run the government, although that's the big picture. It's that those who supposedly run the government don't touch them because they believe that nobody would be left to run the banks if they got rid of these corrupt ones who caused the collapse and are now profited to the tune of billions of dollars. Personally. Nobody would be smart enough to run the banks. I don't believe that at all. I think that there are very smart people in the banking industry who are honest, who could do a very nice job of running the economy through running the banks, rather. So the fact is that Paulson worked for Goldman Sachs, as did Geithner. So you could say, well, Goldman Sachs is running the country. Hello, they're running the country. Is that necessarily bad? I don't know that it's necessarily bad. Not everything Goldman Sachs does should be seen as bad or evil or manipulative or crafty. They're very smart people, and many of the things they do have benefited you. And I have to go back to you. There are many people listening to this show who, during the housing bubble, made money. You bought condos for a low amount. You put in stainless steel appliances. You put in some tile. And you sold it for 20% more in a very short period of time. So in essence, you were flipping houses. If you were flipping houses, you were benefiting from the housing bubble that was created by Goldman Sachs. So you can't now blame them as the villains. Nor can you blame them because you can't unload your final house. In other words, maybe you did 10 such flips and you finally got to the point where you owned a $3 million property and you were going to flip it for $6 million. And all of a sudden, the market fell out from under you and you broke. Don't blame Goldman Sachs. It's just that you didn't get out early enough. So you got to see the whole picture here. And there's another thing I got to say along the way about the Sandlers, Herb and Marion. Now, remember, the Sandlers Time Magazine included in its 25 people to blame for the financial crisis list. He claims they preyed on the poor for years and paid Acorn, which also preys on the poor, to help them. And this is something you must come to understand today. These people, the Sandlers, made a fortune by selling their bank, which was filled with toxic loans, okay? They personally allegedly made $2.5 billion or $2.2 billion, and then they gave tens of millions to the ACLU. I think that they're the single largest donor to the ACLU. They gave them $9 million. They've also given money to all of the left-wing groups that you cannot believe would be allowed in America. Groups such as Human Rights Watch, they gave $23 million. Human Rights Watch hobbles America's fight against Islamic fundamentalism. They gave the ACLU nearly $10 million. The Sandlers also helped underwrite the creation of the Center for American Progress, the liberal fanatic left think tank, according to its president, John Podesta, who I believe was involved in smearing me and having me banned in England. But this is not personal. This is very political. They also paid Acorn and several other organizations millions of dollars. Acorn now. Now, why would a billionaire fund Acorn? You say that doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. According to Matthew Vadum, he says the Sandlers paid Acorn and several other organizations millions of dollars to protect their own interests. You want to hear how? Acorn members told reporters that the Sandlers paid Acorn to go out and attack their primary competition, Wells Fargo. Marcel Reed added that protesters were paid to march in the streets to demand an end to Wells Fargo's supposed predatory lending practices. He goes on, and an Acorn insider said in an interview, Wells Fargo was the Sandler's biggest competition in California for subprime mortgages. Quote, Acorn was deployed to put so much pressure on Wells Fargo that they would not be able to do the subprime loans, close quote. He then goes on, Vadum does, and he says many Acorn members participated in the actions against Wells Fargo, believing that they were part of a legitimate campaign against predatory lending. Here it comes now. Here's the punchline. In reality, it was just another protest for hire operation, the source said. Although the Sandlers have a low public profile, their activist grant making is often more generous than that of George Soros, the preeminent funder of left-wing activism in America. In 2004, they gave $13 million to political committees such as MoveOn.org. Now, I want to go on and tell you something that you may not understand. All these leftist billionaires who you can't understand why, you would think they'd naturally be conservatives. Why would they fund these groups that seem to stand in opposition to people with money? Because they're using them as street thugs, as thugs to protect their interests, to protect them from being investigated, to protest if they are investigated, to throw mud in the eyes of the American people and attack conservatives, to attack anyone on the right, to continue to hound people on the right, to continue to smear people on the right like me, and to try to make you think that the real enemy are people on the right rather than they themselves, who are actually the heart of darkness. Now, we're going back to the movie Too Big to Fail. James Woods plays Dick Fuld. So let's go to Dick Fuld in a minute. Dick Fuld, as I told you before, was the main guy at Lehman Brothers, the CEO. And the company, which had been around for 145 years, I think, died under him. Did he lose a dime? Did Dick Fuld lose anything? 30,000 people, I think, lost their jobs. People lost their life savings. But did Dick Fuld lose anything? No, not that we know of. According to a former Lehman Associate General Counsel, who was responsible for drafting parts of Lehman's SEC filings, Oliver Budd, he alleges that Fuld was paid $529.4 million, $529.4 million over a short period of time between 2000 and 2007, nearly a half a billion dollars. But he also cashed out $469 million in additional money through stock sales. Can you believe this? Just before the collapse. So the fact is that Fuld apparently did very well indeed. The stockholders lost money. You may have lost money. People's lives were destroyed. But he owns a lot of property. In fact, he owns an awful lot of property. In fact, he owns an awful lot of property. They have a five-bedroom home on 3.3 acres on exclusive Jupiter Island, Florida, for which they paid $13.75 million in 2004, which they reportedly tore down and rebuilt because it wasn't good enough for them. He subsequently said he transferred the property to his wife for about $100 just before the collapse. Now, Fold's net worth, though, remains a bit of a mystery, according to William D. Cohen of CNN Money Fortune magazine. His actual net worth is something mysterious, and it's controversial. And I've given you some ideas. It seems to be very high, but the fact of the matter is, Fortune calculated that Dick Fold sold $482 million worth of his Lehman stock between 2000 and 2007. So he was selling out his own company behind the scenes, according to Fortune. How come he has not been investigated? How is it possible? Now, he was brought before Congress, if you remember. In 2008, he appeared at a congressional hearing just after Lehman's collapse, and Fold sparred with Rep. Henry Waxman, who released a chart showing that Fold had made $484 million from 2000 to 2007. Under oath, Fold denied he had made that amount, but he said he had received closer to $310 million during those years. Later in the hearing, Fold conceded it might have been closer to $350 million, but he said it was not $484 million. What am I getting at here? I'm getting at a very important point. How come he did not lose any money, even though he was involved with the complete breakup and destruction of Lehman Brothers? How come that was not shown in Too Big to Fail? How come they end with James Woods drinking a 6,000 bottle of cognac? I think it's the $6,000 variety because I have had a bottle of that myself at one point. I don't actually like cognac. It's very different. Frankly, Hennessy from a corner liquor store is just good. If you want to tie one on, I mean, really, truly, you don't have to wait for the $6,000 cognac. Just go to get a bottle of Hennessy at the corner store, and you know what I mean? You'll be in the same place after about 4 ounces. So James Woods is not shown as Dick Fold in exile, in his billion-dollar exile. He's shown as a ruined, destroyed man. There's another couple of elements of the movie, Too Big to Fail, that should be talked about. Toxic Assets Relief Program. Remember TARP? The movie ends with a bunch of script on the screen. Almost all the money that TARP lent to the banks has been paid back. How do we know that's true? Because what, the government tells us that? Because the banks told us the TARP was paid back? How about the interest on the TARP money? Because it was your money and it was illegal. In fact, the movie does a good job of showing that it was really a bailout of these very people who busted us out, but they were afraid to call it what it was, which was a bailout. So they came up with a new word called TARP. Toxic Assets Relief Program. But remember, the banks got the money at, what, 0.25 interest or zero interest? They paid no interest on the money. How come? Where's the interest they owe we the people? How come that's not investigated? I'll be right back.
Savage.
It's the Savage Nation. If you're not having fun on radio, then get away from the microphone because no one wants to listen to a cranky old man. The first thing I learned when I went in this business is have fun on the radio. And let me tell you something. Not too many people are still having fun on the radio. They're running scared and you can hear it. And that's why people are turning off the radio. Now, it's hard to have fun when you have a Marxist president who is destroying jobs and you have a first lady gallivanting around the world spending money like the Queen of England was in the 19th century or the 18th century, being snubbed by the president of South Africa and it not appearing in the news because they cover the backsides of the president and the first lady like never before in history. It's very difficult, and that's why I tell you we're going to have some fun in the Savage Nation. Talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that. It's only for old people. Talk radio is dead. Cable news is king. Internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows. Talk Radio Network, an independent syndicator. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. more influence than ever. That's if you're in the inner ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense, well, you're gonna make a lot of friends and a lot of unhappy people too. I wouldn't use the word enemies because we don't yet live in North Korea. Our debt is equal to that of where is the country? I want to get it right. I think I remember reading this. What was the debt? Our debt is equivalent to that of Belgium. Belgium. The new borrowing took place overnight and put us in a league with highly indebted countries like Italy and Belgium. Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, Wednesday, Tuesday. Michael, look, I can drive. Sunday, Monday, Wednesday. We're in Belgium. Belgium has nothing going for it. Belgium. Last time I was in Belgium, I had moule. That was about the only thing I remember about Belgium. Everyone was like, the whole country was sort of like a black and white experience. Even though it was in the summer that I was there many, many years ago, it seemed to me like a black and white, you know, drab. I had moo late at night, like 1 o'clock in the morning once, and the police approached me, some gendarme, because I was walking the streets late at night. I guess he thought I was cruising. I wasn't cruising. I couldn't sleep. Where I come from, it was morning. What's his business that I had moules at 2 in the morning with a Belgian beer and walked around the streets? I'll never go back there. How disappointed I was in the beaches outside of Rome. Horrible. Garbage-strewn, rocky, terrible. Nothing going for it. Jones Beach was better than that. And the pizza in New York was better than Roman pizza. That's the thing I'll never forget as long as I live. The pizza in New York was better than it was in Rome. How is that possible? The best pizza I ever had was Greek pizza. I mean, made by Greeks in Marblehead, Massachusetts when I lived there one winter. Go figure. In New England, the best pizza in the world. Was it Greeks? Yeah, the Greeks made very good pizza. How did they do that?
Savage.
In addition to all of the news of the day, which I'm going to do, remember I was saying how did we go from a time when I was a kid, for example, when even poor Italian people who were in my grew up in my neighborhood, they looked up to opera stars. Even the poorest Italians could sing an aria or try to sing an aria. Their role models were people such as Mario Lanza, later on Pavarotti. And take a look at the degeneracy today of a culture where Jersey Shore and the Sopranos are held up as the role models for Italians. Or take a look at the Jewish people. When I was a boy, Jonas Salk was held up as a role model. Take a look at what we have now, Anthony Weiner. And so without further ado, let's go to the wonderful sound production describing the role models and the leadership of the past to the present, from dignity to depravity on the Savage Nation.
We have fun, we're fearless. I mean, we go into the room, we kill it. We go into the club, we kill it. Photo shoots, we kill it. We're in Miami, we're killing it. On the beach, we're killing it.
This is how we do since day one.
I believe that the future generations will look back upon us and judge us as to whether we have been wise or whether we have been profligate and wasteful.
I will not yield to the gentleman, and the gentleman will observe regular order. The gentleman will observe regular order.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
I said a hip. The hip to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang, bang, boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie.
So there we go, from Pavarotti to the degenerate filth of Jersey Shore, the illiterate morons, from Jonas Salk to Anthony Weiner, from Martin Luther King Jr. to a rapper who can hardly speak the English language.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Now, let's talk about Michelle Obama, the paid apologists and sycophants of the Obama Politburo who work for AP and such tell us that Michelle Obama is the classiest first lady, even classier than Jackie Kennedy. And yet I don't know what this first lady has done to be called classy, but I do remember Jackie Kennedy quite well. She was quite something. And I'd like to play a piece from A Blast from the Past so you could hear what a real first lady sounds like. Listen.
These two were on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once, so he painted this picture from photographs.
Now, we don't know whose paintings have been taken down under Michelle's reign. We don't know whether H. Rapp Brown's picture has been put up, or Stokely Carmichael, or Malcolm X, maybe their portraits are hanging in the White House. We haven't any idea, but we do know that somebody has to say something at some point. You know, the Queen has no clothes, you know that one? I grew up reading real literature and listening to real poetry. Most of what you hear as poetry today is filth and garbage, dressed up and gussied up. It's written by illiterate morons who are using this opportunity to debase not only the United States of America, but the language itself. Listen to what real poetry is as we play for you Dylan Thomas's great poem.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good
okay.
Men, the last
beautiful.
Wave.
No, no, keep playing it. I love it.
How bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Yeah, he wrote that at his father's funeral in honor of his father. Now compare that to the filth and garbage which they have the nerve to call poetry. And you wonder why so many children in this country can't read or write. You wonder why so many of them come out hating the society and hating America. You don't have to look any further than who's in the White House. At a certain point, you have to stand up to the tyranny of the big lie. From the White House to the junk house in one administration, how the Obamas have degraded the presidency in the White House. Let me begin by saying that I watched a TV movie after a hard day on the radio and exactly one vodka cocktail. Frankly, I was spent. I searched around and I fell into a movie about a woman with two teenage children who was divorced and meets an apparently nice guy in a hardware store and begins a relationship with him. Now, her son is 16 years old. He returns from military school. He's living in the house. He starts to suspect that the man may be bad. Then he suspects he may be a serial killer based upon certain things that happen in the plot. The woman, though, is in total denial throughout the entire story. No matter what the son discovers, she keeps denying that this, quote, nice guy she met is a serial killer, that there's nothing wrong with him, that the guy makes her happy, and she wishes her son would stop with his paranoia and his suspicions. But as the plot unfolds, and as we see what this new man does, he actually is shown to be a serial killer. He kills an elderly neighbor who has seen a picture of him on America's Most Wanted. He then kills one of the women's friends who asked for his ID and won't give it to her after a small job in her real estate firm. Eventually, the guy's mania shows and he tries to kill the whole family. Now, the point I'm making is this. Obama is like the smiling, nice guy that women meet in the hardware store. They took him into their confidence, while behind the scenes he continues to rape and destroy everything that is valuable and decent and good about America. He is literally destroying the house. And while the women of America who actually elected him were gulled a first time by his good looks and his smooth voice, you would think the women of America would not be gulled a second time. You would think that after Obamacare, the Stimulus Act, the takeover of General Motors, the pandering to the radical Islamists, all of the other incredible disasters that this man has brought upon this nation, from the destruction of the currency, the wreckage of the economy, the joblessness, $5 a gallon gasoline, you would think the women of America would finally see the true face of this president and who he really is. But I'm afraid that just like the woman in the movie, the women of America are just as gullible, and Mr. Obama will continue to destroy until he makes one fatal mistake.
Savage.
Life is a series of terrors with an occasional plateau of happiness and beauty. If anyone tells you it's the other way around, they're lying to you or they're drug addicts. Life is terrifying. You know what real life is? It's a holy terror. That's why you're born screaming and you die screaming. Do you understand that? Do you understand that, mister? That life is not what the teacher told you. Life is not what these freaks in America are trying to teach your children. Life is a nightmare. It's horrible. That's why you're born screaming. That's why you die screaming. But occasionally, as I said, there is a brief respite here and there. I had one last night. And the tougher you make your kid, the happier your kid's going to be. And the tougher you raise the kid, the happier his life is going to be. And the softer you make your son, the worse his life is going to be. The softer you make your son, the more he's going to be stepped on and turned into a worm. We had a heat wave out here in Northern California for three, four days, and that's what it comes like. And, you know, you live with it. I got air conditioning. I remember when I first moved out here, oh, no, we don't have air conditioning out in these parts. Our fog is on natural air conditioning. Yeah, all right, you're smart, are you smoking? I don't know about you, but I can't take the heat. So I got air conditioning in every house I own. I can turn it into a refrigerator wherever I am. We used to call it Indian summer, but we're not allowed to call it that anymore, so we'll call it Native American summer. We had a Native American summer night. Hot, beautiful. So I figured, you know what? I'm going to fire up the old 65 Caddy convertible. And strangely enough, I bought this car in 1994 when I started in radio. It had 52,000 miles on it. It's red. It's 19 feet, 6 inches long. You know, it's from an era in America that I can remember very well. My father was still alive. It was a different world, right? The windows are almost a half an inch thick on the car. I keep it in the garage. I never drive it, right? I keep a battery charge, trickle charger. Of all the cars you own, I mean, I own some exotic cars, I got to tell you. I'm not here to boast about them, but I do. I'm a machinery lover. It's funny. I mean, given my background and my orientation towards nature, I still love machinery in that I'm a true American in that sense. I grew up in the age of the machine and the engine, and I still love engines. I'm not apologizing about it. In fact, all the freaks who bicycle around here all bring their bikes around with machines and engines. But let's not go there, okay? So I get the car. I bring it down to the house. I have it in the garage. And, you know, I have a dog, Teddy, a 10, 12-pound poodle. He's played as Eddie in my novel, Abuse of Power. He's the show dog. He's the clown. He's 7 years old. He's the joy of my life. Then I have a freak dog, Tasha. She's about 5 years old and, like, does nothing for you. Everything is take, take, take. She's like a bad sister-in-law, you know what I'm saying? Or a relative you left behind in Brooklyn. Bitter, nasty, always submissive, you know, nothing good to say, always sitting at. And she's nasty. All she wants is food. But we like her, and we take care of her. Teddy's the show dog. She's the dummy. You know how, like, for a horse, you get a goat. Tasha was got to be Teddy's goat, but she doesn't even do that right. All she does is, like, sit around. So I get a surprise last night. I honked the horn to pick up Mrs. S, and she says, I have a surprise for you. I said, what? She said, I got a new dog. I said, oh, God, no. So she got a Havanese, and she named it Toby. So now there's Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. So I said, what am I going to do, get mad? She got a dog? I don't even know what a Havanese is. I said, why not another small? Never mind, I got a Havanese. They're the cutest little thing. They're from Cuba, native to Cuba, which is good because I love Cuban music. And this is, of course, way before the communists destroyed Cuba. There was a nation called Cuba. It's thought that the dogs came from the Canary Islands. Sabor! Okay, good. Beautiful cutting, guys. You're the best. So the Havanese apparently is a lap dog from Cuba's aristocracy, which doesn't exist anymore. But they're very hardy, wonderful, playful little dogs. To make a long story short, he's only seven, I don't know how old he is. I don't know, 7 months? I don't know what he is. So you'd think, Teddy and him get along great, right? All I said was, is he house trained? Yes. The first thing he did was pee on the wall. Okay, terrific. Great training job. I'm glad to hear it. But I don't care. You know what I mean? I'd rather have a dog that pees on the wall than relatives of the kind. So I have Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. We pile them into the Cadillac. It's a hot night. What could I tell you? I go for a ride. I get on the highway. I shoot down to Sausalito, go around the waterfront. The car was running better than it's ever run for no reason. So she says to me, why is this car running better than it's ever run? It's smooth. You don't even hear this car. It's like a baby carriage. I own a Mercedes S600. It's a beautiful, incredible car. This thing is smoother, right? And has a certain suspension from the 60s that you can't beat. The dogs, it's a flat seat, right? No bucket seats. This is a flat bench seat. So the dogs love to sit between the two people. The top's down. They love the moon. They love the stars. They love the air. Dogs love the outdoors. And I said to myself, you know what I mean? This is it. This is what life is supposed to be. If you get 15 to 30 minutes of this once a year, you're ahead of the curve. It's not about skyrockets. It's not about getting stoned in a nightclub. It really isn't. Maybe it's about three dogs and a loyal companion in a Cadillac with the top down on a hot night. So that was one story. Now here's another story for you. The other day, I went down to Fisherman's Wharf. And I took a little bike ride. I don't eat down there no more because I just don't eat down there no more. But I went into a store that sells nautical items, nautical artifacts in San Francisco's Fisherman Wharf. You know, mixed in with the tourist dreck, the T-shirts. The guy is actually a store that sells real fisherman stuff. But he has artifacts, like nautical artifacts, steering wheels and ship models. So I like to poke around in there. I hadn't been in there in a year. The guy's a big Sicilian guy. He remembered me, of course, but I hadn't been in there any. I go in, so I'm touching this item, that. How much is this? How much is that? I see a pair of shoes, like size 16 shoes. Each shoe weighs 50 pounds, and it's next to a diving helmet. They're diving shoes. They're weighted. So I pick one up, and I struggle it over to the counter, and I say, how much do these Sicilian swimming shoes cost? He broke out in a big laugh. He got a kick out of that one. But I felt bad, so I bought a compass, a $20 compass. I could have bought it in probably a Target store for a buck. But, you know, I don't like to just go look around in a store and just be a deadbeat. You know, I told you, you go in a store, you buy something. But I thought the Sicilian swimming shoe thing was funny. So now I have Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. And that was it. And we stopped at a Thai restaurant that had an outdoor table and a parking lot. See, that's the problem with dogs. Once you have dogs, you no longer eat like a human being inside a restaurant with tablecloths. Now every decision is made upon who has an outdoor table that will let you bring dogs to the outside. So you're limited already. You're already eating in a marginal situation. But you know what? It's a trade-off. I'd rather see a dog next to me and a table that's a little shaky on a terrace, right? And it was dark already, than sit and listen to liberals inside discussing what a great man Obama is, you know, about how evil Nixon was. You know what I'm saying? So I'm eating. The dogs get nothing. What are you going to order a dog in a Thai restaurant? But I even figured that out by now. Wherever I go, you got to order something for a dog. So I said, can I order, a side order of boiled chicken, no spices. Sure, for the dog. They probably charged me $8. I was afraid to look. But to tell you the truth, Toby and Teddy really like that chicken. So that's my life today. Thank God it's not diver shoes. It's three dogs and a Cadillac.
Motor cooled down, the heat went down, and that's when I heard that highway sound. Cadillac setting like a ton of lead, 110 a half a mile ahead. Cadillac looking like setting still, and I caught Maybelline at the top of the hill. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline.
It is Chuck Berry. When America was great, when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. Yeah. Are we ever going to get this country back? Are we ever going to have an American in the White House? Are we ever going to have a government we can trust? Or is it over? You know, there are riots all over the world now. I mean, the people understand that the Western world is so corrupt. The Arabs are rioting. They know that their leaders are corrupt. Of course, because I like stability, and I certainly believe in the electoral process. After all, we have a very fine two-party system where you know one party is so much better than the other. I mean, just listen to Rush. You'll understand who to vote for. But the fact of the matter is, how much more can this country take? $1 billion is $1 billion. I mean, no matter how you cut it, you know, it adds up. $1 billion on Wednesday and another billion on Thursday, that starts to add up. And that's why I say I don't know if we'll ever get this country back.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
There's a project that's being worked on, one of my properties, and there's a lot of guys working on it, many of whom, most of whom are Latino guys, Central American guys. They're really hard workers. They're good guys. They're very, very hard workers. So I spoke to one of them today. Actually, I said, you've got a great haircut. Where'd you get it? It was an interesting kind of Aztec-like haircut. I wanted to get one. So we had a laugh. And, you know, I thought about it when I left. It's not the first time I thought about it. I said to myself, the reason these guys kill themselves to get into this country to work these jobs is because there's no opportunity in their own country, number one. They make a decent living here. I don't care if it's $10, $15 an hour. It's a fortune compared to what they make in their home country. But then I said the other flip side of the coin is these are the jobs that in the past would have gone to boys or young men who don't want to work. You got American boys who would rather stay home with hairnets on planning their night in the club. They won't work. They don't know how to drive a nail. They don't know how to saw a board. They don't know how to lay a wire. They don't know how to attach a pipe. So why do you now you understand why the illegals are here? If the white boys in this country will become useless idiots like Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen, role models for them to remain idiots until they're 35 years old. If these white boys who normally would have done these jobs would have learned a skill in school instead of learning how to put a condom on a cucumber, then you would have a problem. You wouldn't have a problem with illegal aliens. They're filling a vacuum. People need plumbers, electricians, carpenters, laborers. But the white boys are too lazy to do it. They're busy staying, and they come out of college. They got a degree in nothingness. Now under Nancy Pelosi's Obamacare, they can collect medical care till they're 26 years old, laying around in bed all day smoking pot, going out to a club at night, putting on a shirt, looking like a big shot. They don't have 10 cents in their pocket other than what their mother gave them. They don't know how to do a thing. They're worthless. They come out of college. They're useless. Totally useless. Perennial children. Seth Rogen is their role model. Or that other moron, Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler makes a fortune projecting the infantile role of the white male. And that's what we have in this country. So I'm talking about survival of the fittest and how it works, whether on a microbial level or on a macro level, international level, galactic level, right? And as God is my witness, you just have to take it for what it is. I leave the studio. I drive home. I go and sit on the back of a deck, which is right on San Francisco Bay in a little house I own. I mean, I didn't even have an adult beverage. I had a bad headache. I didn't even want to drink, okay? You never drink when you have a headache. Never drink when you're depressed. Never. Did you know that? Did your father teach you that? When you're down, don't drink. No drink, nothing. I'm sitting there. What do I see? I see a pelican out in the bay, maybe 100 yards off from my house. And I see like three, four seagulls trying to, like, I thought steal a fish out of its mouth. And every few seconds, they swoop down, the gulls, and she snaps her big beak and they fly off. Then the pelicans attacked again by three or four gulls who were swooping in like fighter planes on her. And she's just sitting in the water, and I'm saying, wow, they're trying to steal the fish right out of her mouth. This is right off the show. Where I'm telling you, it's like America's having the fish stolen out of its mouth. I get off the air, and there it's going on, and then nature's talking to me again because I have a relationship with nature. But I misread nature. It wasn't that the pelican was fishing and they were trying to steal a fish out of her mouth. It was far more diabolical. She was a sick pelican, and they were trying to kill her in order to eat her while she was alive. So listen to this. The poor old pelican starts to slowly paddle towards me while fending off the gulls trying to kill her. And I swear to God, she comes right up to next to my house. She seeks shelter as though she knows I'm going to be her shepherd. And I'm fending off the gulls with a rake, and I'm trying to get them away. Normally, I feed them old bread and old bagels, and they won't go away, but they got scared. And finally, she stays there, and she looks up at me. And I look in her eye, and I start talking to her like she's my dog, and I'm calling her Teddy, figuring I could communicate with animals, and she doesn't go away. I throw a little bread to her. She won't eat it because I don't think they eat bread, or she was so sick she couldn't eat it all. Meanwhile, I got a good look at her, and either she was a juvenile or whatever, and I'm telling you the truth, within a few 20 minutes later, she started to paddle out again, and again they attacked her. I don't know whether they got her or she went to pelican heaven. So what's the point of the story? The point of the story is everything and nothing. The point of the story is that if you raise your children to be too soft, and if you put them on medication because they feel uncomfortable, they're going to wind up not only having the fish taken out of their beak, they're going to wind up having their beak taken out of the pelican. So now I'll give you a fish recipe, if you'd like, on how to cook fish. Do you know that cooking fish properly took me my entire life to learn how to do? As simple as it is to cook fish, it's one of the hardest things on earth. And most people don't know how to cook a fish. It's the easiest thing in the world. But think of how long it took me to do it. Now, it is true, many decades ago I did it. I lived in Spain for one summer. You know, I thought I was going to go to school in Europe. And I lived in a little apartment in Mallorca in the mid-60s. I used to buy fresh fish and cook it. Who knew how to cook? I threw olive oil in a pan and it smoked. And I threw the fish until it burned and I ate it. I didn't even know what it tasted like. I was drunk most of the time on wine, I think. Who knew? You know, when you're young, you don't really have a taste for food. You eat out of expediency just to make sure you don't faint in between partying. You just make sure that your caloric content is maintained when you're young in order to party on. But it's really simple. But the most important thing about the fish is the mother fish. That's the most important thing to know. The most important thing about the fish is the mother fish. Thank God for the mother fish. You know what I'm saying? So that's number one, the genes, how good it was. And number two, how old it is. That you know already. That's basic. But most of you don't have the guts to smell the fish in a store nor smell the fish in a restaurant. I'm lucky. I grew up with old world relatives who had total and absolute nerve. Butchers they would yell at, don't give me that garbage, bring it out of the freezer. A fishmonger, they make them tell you to push it over the counter to smell it. Restaurants, in my day, you went in a fish restaurant, the waiter actually brought the fish you were going to eat out and put it in front of you so you could smell it. Would you believe it? Today, could you imagine average white fish person, an average pink white fish, suburban white fish male or woman, daring to ask a waiter to bring a fish out to smell it? They would rather die than do that. Because the whole table would be, oh my God, look how impolite she is. Look at that. She didn't vote for Obama, and she asks to smell the fish. How do you like that? But truthfully, your nose, if it actually works, is your best indicator. And then, of course, you know, it has to look right if it's glazed. But then, now let's say we pass the mother of the fish is good. The fish is fresh, meaning it's at least 3 days old. Because you're not getting fresh fish. I don't care where you're buying it. I've spoken to fishermen. Until you eat it, it's 3 days. I don't care where they say it was caught. I don't care how long. Until it gets to you, between the fisherman and the dock and the wholesaler and the truck, it's 2-3 days later. You probably never ate fresh fish in life unless you actually caught the fish. So let's say it's 2 days old and that's fresh fish for us, 2-3 days old. And it still sort of smells not, you know, not. It's simple. Now, do you want it browned or do you want it not browned? Because we're going to put it on a frying pan. We're going to saute it. That's all we're going to do. If you'd like it to have a little brown to it, you've got to use like that fake butter, like a Smart Balance. I don't use regular butter. I don't like the stuff. Never mind the cholesterol. I just don't. I've gotten so. And I use olive oil anyway, but I mix it now because I do like a little browning. So I use a little of the olive. I like Spanish olive oil myself. It's less acidic. And then you don't make it too hot. But don't put that fish in when the oil is just warm. You see, this is the trick. You can't put the fish in when the oil's just sitting there warming up. Because all you're going to do is make the fish oily. But on the other hand, if you make the oil so hot that you put it in, it splashes and burns, it's all wrong. You don't want it to sizzle. You want it to be so hot that it cooks right away, where you hear it go tss, without burning, right? You put the fish in 3 minutes one side, 2 minutes the other. That's if it's a fillet of, let's say, a Petrelli sole, any kind of sole. That's fast. So it's thicker, so you go 4 and 3. Now, what do you put on it when you flip it over once? And then I'm going to stop at the fish recipe because very much like politics. So you do the one side for let's say, the 3 minutes. Now you turn it over. That's where you're going to put all your flavor on the other side. Because if you spice it on the other side, it's going to burn it. I like to use on my – I don't use lemon. I hate the taste of lemon on fish. They came up with that just to mask the smell of old fish, personally. Lemon on fish is used strictly to mask the stink. So if you got fresh fish, throw your lemons away, unless you particularly like an acidic fish, which I don't. I like to put capers, a few capers, and pimentos as my latest flavor addition on fish. Would you believe it? I like pimentos. I don't know why, but pimentos and capers are very nice on the top. And that's the end of the story. And that's the whole reason that I'm good at politics, is because if you know how to pan fry a fish, which I know how to do, then you can also pan fry the news of the day in exactly the same way, lightly and easily without burning it. Because you could easily burn the news, and you could also undercook the news. The same way I just told you how to cook fish is the same way I deliver the news to you. I don't want to overdo it. I mean, I could have made the oil so hot today and thrown the fish, and you would have turned the show up because you would have gotten scared. You understand?
Savage.
So I take you back in time. It's a little history on it. That's enough already. Now it's hysterical. It's not the good part. That already got my father crazy. He'd come home from work, you see, and I was a kid in high school, and I discovered jazz. And my mother was a little more, you know, progressive in that regard, not the liberal progressive. She dared buy a blonde cabineted hi-fi stereo, and he was so mad that she had bought a hi-fi. Because it was modern. He didn't like modern. He wanted something that he got like in a secondhand store that was made of tremendous parts. The sound might not have been, you know. So like he was always interested. Like you know, he was frugal. I mean, he's from it. He had to say. So she got this hi-fi cabinet, and here's this kid gets the record, Nat Cannonball Adderley, and I'm listening to this. He comes home from work, white again from the market. I don't know. It was the snow. I don't know what time of year it was. And here's his nightmare son listening to jazz music. And he figures I'll amount to nothing because, oh, my God, can you imagine him listening to jazz? So I said, hey, Dad, what's wrong? That's not music for you. I said, what do you mean it's not music for me? You don't listen to music like that. I said, why don't I listen to music? I like that music. It's not music for you. It went on and on how it would destroy my mind. Well, it hasn't destroyed it yet. I mean, I've, you know, got a couple of higher degrees, written 28 books, and I have a great career, a great family. What do you mean? Didn't destroy my mind, but it just shows you how people get locked into their view of the world. And it's the same with Jackson Lee and Obama. Since she has used the race card, no, let's put it another, since she sees the world only through the race card or through racial lenses, she always has the attitude that whenever a black person is opposed on any issue, it's because they're black. It could be because of something they did. Or in this case, it could be because what Obama is trying to do is beyond belief. Raise taxes and increase spending? It's the reverse of what works in the real world, Sheila Jackson Lee. But again, she says that Congress is complicating the debt ceiling because Obama is black.
Astounding, isn't it?
I am helping you. I am helping you not have 26% uninsurance in the state of Texas. I'm helping children be insured. I'm helping diverse minorities be insured. And I know during the civil rights arguments, even though we were arguing under the Constitution, there were many policy statements being made. Do we want to live in a nation that discriminates against a person for the color of their skin? In addition to the amendment and constitutional argument, do we want to live in a nation where there are people who are uninsured, cause catastrophic costs to the nation, and others have to pay? I think that is a question that should be considered by the courts.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to AmericaIsRising.com, 800-255-4199, AmericaIsRising.com. I don't feel good. I had chocolate for lunch. I had a terrible, terrible, I went down to the, I'm in San Francisco, so I went down to the, I love this place. They have a ferry terminal here with all, it's like a Pike's Street Market. All sorts of stores, bakeries, and butcher shops, and this, and restaurants. I kind of like the hubbub. And I swear, I never eat chocolate because I'm really disciplined with my diet. I craved sweets, but I don't eat dairy. So I went up to a chocolate stand, and I said, do you have any chocolate that doesn't have any dairy in it? He said, oh, yeah, this one does. I ate it. I am so sick from it. I have a headache. Every joint in my body hurts. Little did I know that chocolate promotes uric acid, which provokes gout-like reactions or arthritis in people. I mean, you look at foods with uric acid production. You know what I have to live on? I have to live on pineapple, papaya, blueberry juice, and vodka in order to never have another pain. It's not such a bad diet when I think about it. If I could just drink vodka and blueberry juice and live on papayas and pineapple, I might live longer altogether. You look at foods that actually promote uric acid and cause swelling in the joints. It's virtually everything I like. Shrimp, beer, bread, even oatmeal, which I really don't like. I never know why. Every time I eat oatmeal, I feel a little sick. Oatmeal promotes uric acid. Would you believe it? It's pretty interesting when you look into foods. And as much as I thought I knew about foods, there's things you never know about anything. And your body is a pretty good teacher, incidentally. But there are other topics out there. 1-800-449-8255. If you rob a loaf of bread, you go to jail for 3 years. If you rob $10 billion, you go to the head of the SEC. So how does General Electric, according to the New York Times, pay no U.S. taxes for 2010, despite reporting worldwide profits of $14.2 billion, including $5.1 billion earned in the United States? We understand that with the foreign profits, they can defer payments, saying that it's overseas income and they're going to pay the tax in the overseas countries. But as a matter of fact, General Electric earned $5 billion in the U.S. and paid nothing. How did they do it? Well, it's a very interesting game. Number one, they buy off the government. That's number one. I cannot go into every detail, but there's a fabulous article on this written by a Kathleen Pender, which we're going to link up on michaelsavage.com. Let me summarize it for you so that you understand it. Bloomberg Businessweek reported that Google, wonderful group of individuals they are, good friends of Nancy Pelosi, Google used the convoluted process known as the double Irish and the Dutch sandwich to cut its overseas tax rate to just 2.4% between 07 and 09. How would you like to have been paying only 2.4% of your income between 07 and 09? Wouldn't you feel good today? You probably paid closer to 40% with all of your state taxes and your local taxes. How about General Electric, a good friend of Obama? According to the New York Times, paid no U.S. taxes for 2010, despite reporting worldwide profits of $14.2 billion, including $5.1 billion earned in the United States. How did they do it? Well, they used a variety of tax breaks, including a so-called active financing exclusion, which is just a made-up excuse that lets it defer U.S. tax on foreign lending income. Generally, U.S. companies pay no tax on their foreign profits until they repatriate them or bring them back home. But rather than pay the tax, most U.S. multinationals let their overseas profits accumulate offshore until they can persuade Congress to give them a tax holiday on repatriated profits, and it's been done before. In 2004, the crooks in Congress passed a law that gave U.S. companies a one-time chance to repatriate their foreign profits at a low tax rate of 5.25%. And then what would happen? Well, the companies argued that they would use the profits to increase spending and hiring domestically, and that getting a 5% tax price would be better than getting nothing if the companies never brought their earnings home. But they lied. They didn't spend the money here, and they're about to do it again. According to the IRS, 843 corporations took advantage of this tax holiday to repatriate $362 billion, of which $312 billion qualified for the tax break. And although these crooked companies say they used the money as Congress intended, many studies found they did not, and I'm not going to point it out to you. You want to hear the names of some of these wonderful, patriotic American companies? A report by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities said that companies including Hewlett-Packard, Pfizer, Ford, Merck, and Honeywell announced large layoffs shortly after repatriating funds at a very low tax rate. Now companies such as Cisco, Oracle, and Google are lobbying for another repatriation holiday, saying it could bring back up to $1 trillion in foreign earnings. I say, well, you know what I say, but it's nonsense. It's all a scam. So now you've learned why you're behind the eight ball and why the multinationals are laughing all the way to the White House.
Savage.